Hey everyone, it's your host Richie Burke, and thank you for tuning in to the Go-Getters Podcast. I was excited to talk to Catherine Gale on today's episode just because right now in our country, about 60% of us desire a viable third party. Congress has an approval rating that fluctuates in the 15 to 30% range, and it really feels like we are and have been for a little while more divided than ever, and very polarizing messages coming from the right and the left. And there's a reason for this that I wasn't really aware of. And Catherine does an amazing job of breaking down the whole politics industry and why the candidates that a lot of us feel like we have to choose from, not want to choose from, are either very far on each spectrum. So for those of you who don't know Catherine, she is a business leader, entrepreneur, author, and speaker. She's the founder of the Institute for Political Innovation. She was formerly the CEO of Gale Foods, a $250 million high-tech food manufacturer. And she recently co-authored with Harvard Business School professor Michael Porter the book, The Politics Industry: How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. She is also on several nonprofit boards. And she's presented some very interesting ideas. And a lot of you may be thinking, whoa, well, great. She has ideas. How is any change actually going to happen in our political system? At least that's what I thought at first. But her ranked choice voting has actually gotten picked up by, it got picked up by Alaska. It could be getting picked up by more states soon. And I really like her ideas as someone who's in the middle politically, and she's making some real good progress and doing something that could really change our country for the better. So I hope you enjoy this episode. And just to let you know, this is live from the Milwaukee Rotary Club. It was not recorded in studio, but audio should be good enough. And thanks again for tuning into the Go-Getters Podcast. And thanks to Catherine for coming on today.
So before getting into politics, you ran a very successful $250 million food company, family business. You sold that back in 2015 to focus on political innovation. What set you on that path?
Yeah, so it's always hard when you need to make transitions in your life. I actually was at my company, my old company, Gale Foods, this morning. That's where I came from here, and was so excited to see their expansion, et cetera. So a lot goes into a decision like that, and I continue to love that company. So, but the real answer is I sold it and moved on for multiple reasons. The one I'll share with you is just this idea that life is short. My mother died when she was 46 years old. I was 23. My brother was 11. Even as I've, you know, I've gotten over it, I should say, in a sense, you know, I just really left with this idea of how life is short. And when I, in like many of you, found myself as a citizen deeply concerned about the trajectory of our country, particularly what was happening in Washington, D.C., and I felt that there were some contributions that I could make. I loved my company, but I couldn't keep doing that when this was calling. And so I realized, you know, that it was time sensitive and that my own life could be short, and this is the area I wanted to sort of go for broke in. And it's great because this area is, my work now is much harder. Like, you know how in business we think there's so many things we don't control? Okay, let me just say, I had so much more control over how we were going to do this quarter than I do as an individual over how these political changes can take place. But I love living on sort of the edge of that amount of risk when the problem seems so worth taking that risk.
Yeah, and the solution that you're proposing, let's just dive right into that, and then we can go through the backstory of why and the impact it's making and really how gridlocked and messed up the political system is right now. So final five voting, can you touch on that and explain it to the audience exactly, essentially what you are proposing?
Great. So thank you for starting with the solution. Since I spoke here, the really good news is that I no longer have to talk to you from solely a theoretical standpoint. Like, listen to my good idea, and I like it. I think it's a great idea. But it actually, this solution that I'll talk to you about in a moment, now exists. So what I'll describe is what we should change in our election system in order to get different results out of Washington, D.C. But I want to start by telling you that the state of Alaska adopted this new system in November of 2020. Their citizens voted for it, and now everybody from all of their federal officials to their state legislature and their governor is elected under this new system. And that idea came to them through my 2017 publication. So it's amazingly exciting. Then I'll tell you the second thing that makes it not nearly as theoretical. We in Wisconsin have benefited from extraordinary bipartisan leadership in Madison because 22 co-sponsors introduced a bill in Madison about the changes I'll describe just a couple of months ago. It might be one of the only efforts to sort of change things in our political system in the country that's truly bipartisan right now. And so we have gone from when I was here saying, you know, maybe we should try this, to having real legislation that we are on track to pass. I mean, I'm fine if they do it this week, that will work for me, but they might not do that. So to do it in 2023 is the legislation. What is the solution? And I'll describe it, and then you'll probably ask me, like, why it's what it's a solution to. So my work, I'm laser focused right now on how we vote, with the idea being that how we vote is how our elected officials get their jobs, and it's how they keep their jobs. So whatever makes us get and keep and grow in our jobs is likely what we feel incented to do. I propose, and I work with a bunch of people now such that I can say we propose, that we change how we elect our officials to Congress using a new system called Final Five Voting. And Final Five Voting is the combination of two simple changes to our election system. First, in the primary, right now we vote in the Republican primary or the Democrat primary. Under the new system, there would be a single ballot. There would no longer be a Democrat primary or Republican primary. There'd be one ballot, one primary. All the candidates running would appear on this same ballot, Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Independents, Libertarians. And you go to the polls, pick your favorite of all those people. Polls close, we count votes, and then the top five finishers automatically advance to the general election. So we're not advancing one Democrat, one Republican, we're advancing five candidates. Now, we have a diverse debate, dynamic competition between visions, ideas, candidacies, between the primary and the general. And then we make one other change, because here's the thing, we're going to now benefit from competition and what competition brings to us, but we have to figure out how to pick who wins, because it's not as simple as, which is to say that when you have five candidates, we don't accidentally want to elect someone with, let's say, 21% of the vote. Because if we did that, like if the vote split reasonably equally between five people and we elect 21%, then that person is really not representing the whole district, right? They're representing that narrow slice. So here's what we do. Now that we have dynamic competition, we do what comes naturally to us. We rank them, which is to say, when we go into the general election, we see our five choices, and you simply indicate the order of your preference. This, like, you're my first choice. Karen, you are my second choice. All the way down to, you know, the fifth person, the last place person. Oh my goodness, over my dead body, do I want you to become my senator? I didn't use any names for that. So we do that, and it's easy. It's like you say to someone, oh, if they don't have vanilla ice cream, get me chocolate. We know how to do this. Everybody can rank as many or as few of the candidates as they would like. Now, when the polls close, we count all the first choice votes. And if one of those five has a true majority over 50%, great, election's over. They're clearly the choice of that district. They're the winner. But if the vote has split and there is not a consensus winner to represent the entire general electorate, no problem. We eliminate the candidate who came in last. And if you had selected that candidate as your first choice, but they're now out of the race, your single vote is automatically transferred to your next choice among the remaining four. And then we run the totals between those four candidates. And if someone has a true majority, they win. If not, we eliminate someone from the bottom. This is called instant runoff voting. And it is exactly like a series of physical runoffs. But instead of having to keep showing up for another election, you simply cast all your votes at once. This results always in the election of the candidate with the greatest appeal to the most number of voters. And combined, open top five primaries, instant runoff general elections, change the incentives and liberate our elected officials so that they are more likely to be able to solve problems in the interest of their districts, their state, and their country when they're in Washington, D.C. And that is the solution. It's called final five voting.
Test, one, two, three. All right, great. And it does make a lot of sense because it eliminates the problem of people feeling like they're going to throw away a vote, essentially. Like, I don't want anyone to give me too much shit, but I did vote for Gary Johnson in the Hillary and Trump election, and I didn't feel that good about it, even though, like, I didn't like either of the other two candidates because I knew that I was going in and essentially throwing away that vote, but I wanted to vote out of being respect of being an American citizen. But in this way, I could have had him as number one and then ranked the other people, and my vote still would have made an impact until that one candidate got over 50% and that person would have became president.
You know, you're totally right, which is what's interesting about you is that you actually did choose to, quote unquote, waste your vote. So many people, you know, don't do that. They just stay home because there's no one they want to vote for. Or they just, you know, pick the lesser of two evils. And the effect that this has on our system is in some ways less about how much more satisfying it makes it for the voter, although that's a great thing. The fact is, if we had final five voting, those wouldn't have been your only four choices. And I don't just mean you would have had five choices. What I mean is, the reason right now why we have so many elections that feel like lesser of two evils elections is because we have the wasted vote and the spoiler problem. So Gary Johnson ran, but most competitors to Trump and Hillary didn't. Jill Stein ran, but most don't, because they know that no one's going to be able to vote for them. So they can't raise any money. They can't mount a challenge. So effectively, the way we vote now, where we say whoever has the most votes wins, even if it's not a majority, is the reason why we never have any more choices. And let me be really clear. Our problem is not that we have, you know, only two choices, as in that we have only two parties. Our problem is that the current two are guaranteed to be the only two ongoingly, regardless of what they do or don't get done on behalf of the country. Their places are guaranteed. So I have no problem with the Republicans or the Democrats. What I want is that in order to keep their positions and be successful, is that they have to be making the voters happy and solving our problems instead of being able to keep those positions based on the odd incentives in how we vote.
Yeah, and a lot of us will go to an election and be like, oh, we're stuck with these two or something like that. And in the book, you talk about how bottlenecked the primaries are. And if you're a middle of the road type of candidate who's not really far left or really far right, it's almost impossible to get through the primary unless you skew that way, because the primaries are, they only get 20% turnout, and the people who actually vote in the primaries are very far on either side. Some of them are, I don't even think, open. Can you touch on the whole primary system and why this is so important to actually get kind of some more middle of the road candidates in these elections?
Yes, thank you. The key, so, you know, Richie, again, he started with the solution when I said it's final five voting, but what is it the solution to? So again, I've talked about this with some of you before, but I will say here, this idea of changing how we vote makes most people think that my biggest concern, and that any of our biggest concerns, should be who's going to win. And yes, that totally matters. We need great candidates. We need them to do their jobs, all that. But here's what really matters is what the winners, whoever they are incented to do and have the freedom to do when they're in Washington, D.C., which is to say that right now, what everybody, I'll say everybody, okay, there are some exceptions here, but what everybody in Washington, D.C. is incented to do is to make the voters in their party primaries happy, because over 80% of elections, for example, in the U.S. House, are decided in the primary. So you guys are kind of familiar with this. Like, you'll say, oh, yeah, that's a red district, right? That's a Republican district, which means that you already know whoever won the Republican primary is going to win in November, right? Totally going to win. Oh, that's a blue district. You know whoever wins the Democratic primary is going to win in November. And the problem with this is, as you just said, Richie, many fewer people participate in primaries. Recent analysis by an organization I work with, Unite America, shows that about 10% of voters participate in these party primaries. And these voters tend to be more ideological than voters as a whole. So they're further to the right, they're further to the left. They're oftentimes more single issue voters. And as a result, all candidates are pushed to go further to the right and further to the left than the general electorate as a whole really wants. But again, it's not totally about who gets elected. Remember, it's about what they do or don't do. So I would say our senators and representatives are not free. In this land of the free, they are not free to lead. They are not free to say, you know, out here what they can say behind closed doors, because they can't win their party primaries if they say out here what they say behind closed doors. Because the party primary is a place where organized interests and the parties themselves, et cetera. I actually sometimes use the word, it's like a killing field. That's where all the pressure is put on, which is why what we see right now, Republicans in Washington, D.C. can evaluate the merits of legislation, yes. But even no matter what they think of a bipartisan piece of legislation, the most important question they have to say is, let me look over my shoulder at my election that's happening in less than 2 years if I'm in the House, right? And I'll say, who is going to primary me, meaning run further to my right? And right now, that is what former President Trump is using as a way to control. And by the way, he didn't invent that. That has been used. It's just more in the news now that President Trump would like to primary Republicans who don't support them. That support him. That means take them out in the primary. And on the other side, it's being talked about slightly less, but every Democrat is looking over their shoulder and saying, who's going to primary them? So let me give you a concrete example. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, whom you may know of as AOC, is considered perhaps quite likely to primary Chuck Schumer, who's currently the Democrats, leader in the Senate, which means that when Chuck Schumer is trying to lead all of the Democrats in the Senate, he's also saying, I have to not give AOC something to run against me and take me out in my primary. Now, by the way, they need to care what their voters think. No question. You should care very much if voters don't want to vote for him and if they want to vote for AOC. But not if just 10% of voters don't want to vote for him. Every politician needs to be able to make their case to the general electorate. That's where we should be deciding, because that's where everybody participates. And then we would likely both elect different people, but more likely, even if we elect the same people, they will have the freedom to do different things. They'll have the freedom to appeal to a broad cross-section. And by the way, every red district has tons of Democrats, and every blue district has plenty of Republicans. They will actually begin to care about everybody in their district, because that's how they win.
Hey everyone, it's your host Richie Burke, and thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode of the Go-Getters Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any topics, guest suggestions, or just want to give some feedback, feel free to reach out. Head to ggmm.io. That's ggmm.io. We've got a nice form on our website. And if you are looking to grow your business and have a big 2021, whether that's through podcasting, digital advertising, or our video services, we would love to hear from you. Again, you can head to our website, ggmm.io. Thanks again for tuning in. Let's get back to the episode.
It was an interesting point you brought up, that these politicians have to say stuff that basically appeals to them getting reelected in the primary. I was talking to Stephen Olicara, who I've interviewed for Rotary before, and he knows a lot of politicians, and he was saying, yeah, they're actually pretty normal guys in person that want to do well, but then on Twitter, they'll like go on this tirade that's so far left or so far right, and I was like, oh, really? It kind of hit me. It didn't exactly make sense, but now I know why after reading your book and understanding. One thing I wanted to talk about is, I don't remember the exact number. I think it's about 90% of the time the candidate who raises the most money wins the election. I know it's high. It's in that range. You might know the exact number. And in your book, you talk about political currency. There's really two forms of currency. One is votes and one is dollars and money. And you want to make votes a more powerful currency, which it's really not right now, and dollars a less powerful currency, which obviously I just said 90% of elections that raise the most money win the election. Can you touch on that and how your solution kind of moves some power back to the votes?
Oh my goodness. Thank you for asking me that. So some of you may recall that my analysis and the theory that from which final five voting becomes my preferred solution comes from saying, let's look at politics, not government, but politics as an industry, and think about whether we're getting the same kind of results in that industry as we get from healthy competition in any, you know, industry that we have worked in outside of politics. And the answer to that is no, and it's because of, you know, all these rules, norms, and practices that give us unhealthy competition in the industry. But there's also another thing going on in this industry which makes it different in the industry of politics, and that is what Richie just said. There are two currencies in the industry, which is to say some customers of politicians pay with votes, which is to say that's what they earn from us. That's why they use those terms. Did I earn your vote? Okay, yes, you did. I'm voting for you. And then other customers pay with money that, by the way, they legitimately need. Okay, they need money to run their campaigns. No problem with any of that. We as a country have had a long dialogue now about the corrupting influence of money in politics. And indeed, it's certainly there. But you know how sometimes the right way to solve something is not to go directly at it? The reason why, let me say one thing. First of all, we can't really fix money in politics because it requires, for a big fix, a constitutional amendment. Secondly, we don't actually really know how to fix it without dramatic unintended consequences. But since we can't do it, let's not even fight about the theoretical. We can't do it until we get a country that would pass a constitutional amendment, and then we could figure out the best way to do it if we wanted to. In the meantime, here's the thing. The reason the money's a problem is because it's more important than the votes. So instead of trying to make the money less important, instead of trying to make the money be less, you know, like reduce it, we need to actually just make votes be worth more. It's almost like we have an exchange rate problem, that the value of the currency that should be the most important is worth nothing, which is to say the only votes that matter as an incentive for your elected officials in Washington right now are the votes that they get in their primary. If you only show up in the general election, your vote is pretty much immaterial to them. Zero. So, and by the way, in Wisconsin, we have 8 districts where that's the case for our federal, for a House. And we have 1 district where the general election matters. Ron Kind's district is competitive in the general. So you turn out in the general in Ron Kind's district, your vote, you know, makes a difference. But if you turn out in the general and the other places and you skip the primary, you know, you could just stay home for that. So point being, if we raise the power of votes, we automatically decrease the power of money, because one of the reasons there's so much money in politics is because it's a great ROI. If you invest, it's one of the questions, did they win because they got the money, or did they get the money because everybody knew they were going to win? And the people with the money want to have access to the people who are going to win. When you make competition so much more dynamic, it's a lot riskier investment on the part of the money, because you can't be exactly sure that your investment is going to pay off. So paradoxically, we'll make votes more important, and it is also likely to reduce self-interested money in politics because it decreases the expected ROI.
So in the book, you talked about how during the Gilded Age, which was pretty much, it was over 100 years ago, late 1800s, early 1900s, we were kind of in a similar position of political dysfunction. Today, the citizens were fed up with, and political reformers actually came along and made an impact. Can you touch on that movement that happened over 100 years ago? Does it remind you at all of today? Does it make you more optimistic that there can actually be change in the future?
It makes me totally optimistic, and it also makes me super excited about being from Wisconsin, because Wisconsin was one of the leaders of that era of change a little over 100 years ago. Wisconsin actually was the first state to take party nominations out of the proverbial smoke-filled back room and create the party primary so that people would have a say, because basically the winners were being picked in smoke-filled back rooms. And today what I'm saying is that wasn't good in the way it was then. Party primaries aren't helping us now. We need to have the winners be picked in the general election. And this kind of change is what our founders gave us the power to do. Article 1 in the Constitution gives every state in the country the power to make the rules for how our House and Senate members are elected. It's why when we watch, you know, elections in other states, we're like, wait, how come it's so different everywhere? It's because every state's in charge in our federal system. And that means that we in Wisconsin can choose to change this whenever we get critical mass of agreement on it, and in our case,
convince our legislators that that's what we need them to do. And it allows for, quote, laboratories of democracy. This was Justice Brandeis, a former Supreme Court justice, who talked about federalism, which is to say every state can do things differently as guaranteed by our Constitution, for creating an opportunity to kind of experiment with things and see how they would work. So we are now in my area watching the experiment that is Alaska, which already implemented, not final five voting, they implemented final four voting, because I used to be for four in the primary instead of five. So implemented final four voting. And we are seeing how that's altering the behavior of their state legislature and governor and federal delegation. And we can make this happen in Wisconsin as soon as enough of us tell our legislators that we need them to pass this. And by the way, there are people in this room, like Eric and Mary Isbister, who are here, who are your fellow Rotarians, who are deeply engaged in this work and have been to, you know, meetings of us internally figuring out how we do this, because we have an organization called Democracy Found, and have been to multiple meetings now with our elected representatives in Madison making the case for this. And that is really how our democracy works. I mean, it is so unbelievably cool to go meet with, I mean, I'm sure you guys do this, you're engaged people, but, you know, to go meet with our legislators and be like, oh, they need to listen to me in a sense. You know, like, here I am, we have an idea. We're so all in this together. And we are doing what citizens do when they want things to be different. And it's actually not just a power the Constitution gave us, I think also therefore it gave us a responsibility to say, oh, I can't just complain about this. I can look at it and go, well, of course it's that way because that's what the system incents. So now that I know that, I better, you know, do something.
I want to ask you one more question, and then we'll have time for questions. When you set off on this journey, I guess six-ish years ago, what's been the most surprising thing to you, and what are you, I guess, most encouraged by for the future?
Let me respond by saying I actually had lunch last year outside, but with a friend of mine from high school. And we had grown up young Republicans together in my high school. And she said to me at the time, aren't you surprised? Like how far this work has gotten in Wisconsin. The fact that you have as part of your leadership team, the, you know, single person who had a fundraiser for Trump in 2016, as well as one of the very largest progressive donors in the state, agreeing on this, that everything we're doing is bipartisan, cross-partisan, even in this time. You know, so she's saying, aren't you sorely surprised and you're going to have this legislation? And I said, no. Like, so we could say what, you know, surprised me the most, but actually I think it's what hasn't surprised me, as I was saying to her, I am not surprised that when we go to our fellow American citizens, no matter what party they've identified with, that I'm not surprised that we find there a legitimate frustration with how things are in Washington, D.C., and that then when people see that the system guarantees they're going to continue to be this way and that there's no like mythical change candidate that can work outside the system that's going to change things, and then you show them that we actually have power over the rules that are the biggest part of our problem, that I was not surprised that people said, yes, I'm in. I would have been shocked if people said, yeah, no thanks. I think I'm gonna stick with it how it is. This looks pretty good to me in Washington, D.C., because nobody says that. And I think that the key now is revitalizing basically this spirit of civic engagement that already lives in you guys, which is why you're Rotarians and why we said the pledge and all that, to own that we continue to be creating the great American experiment, that the founders gave us a pocket constitution and that there are 6,000 pages of Senate and House rules and a gajillion pages of, you know, election rules in every state, and that when those get screwed up, we own those. The founders said we were in charge, and so now we can do it. And so I'm not surprised that people buy in, and I'm not really surprised that it still takes a little bit to get us off our chairs to do something about it. But that's, you know, what we need to do next.
Any questions? Yes.
Oh, yes, I'll repeat the question. Okay, so it's Brett's question, and it's unbelievably important. So he said, and I'll paraphrase, many of the things that he, I'll just say it a little bit differently. So he's a Democrat. He feels he's benefited personally from what he's described as far-left policies, and that has been helpful to be able to get some far-left Democrats elected. And he noted also that over time, civil rights, gay marriage, what's another one you said?
Ending Jim Crow,
that these things were not, at the moment that they were moved forward, you know, like the most popular things in the whole world. I mean, that they had to be moved forward by gay marriage was not supported by more than half of the country at the time. Okay, so he's saying, how can we get those benefits of that kind of progress under the system important? And I agree with you, innovation in our companies and in every human endeavor rarely happens at sort of the soft and safe middle. Innovation arises almost always from what is at the time the fringes of thought, of technology, etc. The United States did not arise out of, you know, some groundswell around the country that democracy should be good or whatever. It was innovative and it was fringe and it was risky. So the question for us is, how do we get the benefits of both the kind of innovation that has leaders lead us to solving, you know, to putting Jim Crow in our past, to giving rights to our LGBT citizens to marry whom they want, et cetera. How do we do that? I am not for a squishy middle, and this system doesn't do that. What we're missing right now is that we think that we have to get, that in order for views to be represented, we have to get someone who is exactly like us or believes exactly like we believe and put them and elect them, and then other people who believe different things get someone who believes something like really almost always it's binary now, like sort of totally different, and then they fight it out and we wait to make progress for when, quote, our side is totally in control, like a trifecta control of government either at the state or the federal level. What this system, here's what I'm going to answer this a tiny bit different way, which is to say, let me give you an example. There was a gentleman in a recent event I did, and he's from New York City, and he's a Republican, and he said in his question, there's only 20% of us that are Republicans, and what you are proposing means that maybe there could be 5 Democrats, and I'll have no one to vote for in the general election. And first of all, I said I doubted that would be true. He'd probably have a Republican. That's a different issue. But I said, but here's what you also just told me, sir, is that you would like to cast your vote for someone that you just told me has zero chance of ever winning, which is you're never going to elect a Republican, and that's the most you expect out of your democracy. What you could have with Final Five voting is that your vote would have an impact on who eventually wins. Mayors of New York City will also care about Democrats, so about Republicans. So what we have here is we have the ability to have fringe ideas out, and I call them fringe. That doesn't mean negative to me. Innovative ideas, let's call them, arising from the fringes, and they will have a place in the dialogue. So maybe for gay marriage, we would have had a candidate be one of those 5 years and years and years before even like an Obama, you know, finally came on board with gay marriage. we get to bring candidates in who are for outside ideas and bring them to the general election and put their case in front of people long before their decided issues. So we're actually putting more innovation into the system, not less. And when someone takes a leadership position, okay, like I know you say that when gay marriage was passed, 50% of the country wasn't for it. But if enough of the country had been for it and someone was making their case to the general election, people might have been able to vote yes on something around those rules sooner because they would know that they wouldn't be primaried out, you know, on in their next election. What we need is a system that combines innovation, that combines loud voices across any dimension, multiple dimensions of issues, and then gives our politicians freedom to find consensus around those systems at the same time. Because what we have right now is we have this, and then they can never find consensus. And if we go another way, we'll just have a squishy middle, which we can't have. So this combines Final Five voting and sends the best of both worlds. And we will still have to advocate passionately to get changes that we want policy-wise.
Karen, go ahead.
Karen's question is, what about unintended consequences? And have we thought through some of what those could be for Final Five voting? Yes, it's a super important question anytime you're doing systems incentive design changes, absolutely critical. And I think that no matter how confident I am about this system, I want to come to it all the time with a degree of humility, which is the unintended consequences part of it. You know, maybe I'll be wrong. And some consequences from this system could turn out to be deleterious, right? Because they have been for other people over time. But right now, the due diligence that we've done, and by working through the issue theoretically, like the same way you have innovation, you know, in technology or engineering or something. I mean, there is a blueprint and theory and laws of things that. That you're taking into account when you design something. So like, for example, we're taking into account laws of human behavior that, for example, there's only so much courage that a politician is going to have if it's going to guarantee that you lose their election. That's just a law of human behavior. So in going through that, we do not come up with systemic unintended consequences, which is to say that this system, Final Five voting, is the most likely to align the incentives and balance the trade-offs of any, you know, multiple kinds of systems as any other that we can come up with. One of the things I will tell you, which shocked me. There's no perfect way to vote. Beginning in 1750, a man named the Marquis de Condorcet in France started writing about a whole system, which is not the one I proposed, but called Condorcet. And since then, there have been generations and generations and generations of people who spend their entire careers in voting theory and public choice theory. And you have no idea how many different ways we could vote. It's crazy, tons. And so we did due diligence those to figure out which one would. And by the way, when you vote differently, it changes who wins. What we're concerned about is, you know, changing what the winners are incented to do. So we go through all of those things. And I'll tell you that after that, the only thing after all those hundreds of years of fighting that these theorists agree with is that plurality voting, which is a way we do it now, whoever has the most votes win, that's bad. So they agree on that one thing. And this new system fits their criteria. And after that, Karen, we have to rely on laboratories of democracy, which is going to make this case. It's going to get passed in different states at different times, and we're going to see what happens. And I'll go back to Brett's question for a second. Brett, in Alaska, They made the change also for their state legislature, which we're not doing here. And Alaska had a very, very, has a Republican trifecta in their state legislature. And now they have formed a governing coalition in their assembly, the lower house of their state legislature, of independents, Democrats, and Republicans together, who are together governing as the majority. So it's not just a party thing anymore. So Democrats in Alaska's House were completely re-enfranchised, whereas before they had zero power. Now they have power because the Republicans who are willing to work with the Democrats won't automatically lose their primaries. Does that mean that the Democrats in a red state are now going to pass like far left policies? No, because they're governing in a coalition, and then they have a Republican Senate, and they have a Republican governor. Does it mean that they have a lot more power and influence, I should say influence, than they did before? Absolutely. And the Republicans who agreed with them on some things before behind closed doors but couldn't afford to find middle ground can now do so. And the same will happen in red states. And if we're afraid of that, if we're afraid that, yes, we want it to happen, like if you're a Republican, you want to make this change in blue states so that, you know, Republicans are re-enfranchised in blue states, and in red states we want to make this change so Democrats are re-enfranchised. We can't be afraid of, you know, the enfranchisement of all of our citizens and having them work together to find consensus, because that actually is what the country is designed to do, is to work together to find consensus, that we don't all get, you know, everything we want. And once again, I will say, I believe that this system will, not just I believe, the theory, the analysis of the way humans behave and the analysis of what competition does in an industry demonstrates that this system of competition for how you win and keep your job will provide both the innovation and the consensus finding. Yeah, the question is, what's my opinion of the Electoral College and what happens to it under the proposed system? First answer, under this proposed system, final five voting, nothing happens to the Electoral College. This is my final five voting, which is, yes, a term I coined, all of that. But, you know, this system in Wisconsin, we're proposing it apply only to elections to Washington, D.C., where the divides are so extreme that we have gridlock and dysfunction and demonizing of the other sides. Some states will also apply it to their state legislature. We wouldn't pass that here because it would be just much harder to get through the legislative process if people were changing the rules on their own, you know, heads. We want to start with the one thing where virtually everybody agrees that Washington, D.C. is broken. Now, coming back to the other piece of the Electoral College, one of the things that was really important to me coming out of business is I only want to spend time on things that, even though I developed a whole theory that's now called politics industry theory, I only want to spend time on things that are not theory. I don't want to spend time on things that we can really change. And so, and that if we change them would make a difference. So I talk about whether things are powerful and whether they're achievable. The thing about the Electoral College and why I spend no time on it is because it requires a constitutional amendment to change, which makes it in our current environment not achievable, because the states that have more power, by the way, under the Electoral College are also the states that would not pass changing it because it wouldn't give up that power. So I'm not saying other people shouldn't work on constitutional amendments, but life is short and I intend to be alive when the things I'm working for become successful, and I would be dead if that were my issue. I also have to say, let me tell you one thing. You have a dysfunctional Congress. It really is not going to save the country, even if any one of us got our perfect president. They have to sign the legislation Congress is going to give them. And if every single person of the 538 people in Congress are looking over their shoulder to the left and the right, where they are forbidden to work with their fellow citizens, there's no president that's going to change that, no matter which way we decide, which is why, once again, democracy is, yes, a bit about changing who wins, but very much about ensuring that whoever the winners are have the freedom to lead and to represent their entire districts.
Catherine, I think we're out, but are you hanging around after at all if people have questions?
Oh, I will hang around, but could I say where people could go for more information?
Yeah, that was what I was going to end on. Is there a call to action for people who want to support the cause?
Okay, I love that. Yes, call to action. Okay, exactly. We have the legislation. It's not going to be a failure if it's not passed this session, by the way. Okay, we'll reintroduce it. It often takes multiple sessions, and you shouldn't expect that we're going to pass it this session. We're building our support. So what we need call to action is any one of you who wants to get engaged with our organization, like Eric and Mary have, go to our website, democracyfound.org, and just be in touch with us. And our extraordinary executive director, Sarah Eskridge, will be in touch with you. You can volunteer for as little as, you know, some phone calls to your state representatives. So it's not a lot, but they're not going to change it if we don't say we want it. So like I and Sarah, for example, we've gone as far as we can go without more people, because we don't, you know, have any more say in Madison than any, you know, one of the other citizens has. So please be in touch with us about that. And then the second thing is, our legislators are also not going to change this if in the end, let's say they buy into it and they think it's a good idea, but if in the end nobody knows what they're doing, which is to say it would be irresponsible of our legislators to change how we vote if nobody in their state has ever heard of it. So let's say we go to every one of them and convince this was a good idea, and then they were going to vote for it, and then the citizens would be like, oh my God, what did you do to my elections? So please spread the word about Final Five voting. Two, I request of each of you, please spread the word, if you like it, to two people each. And the best way to do that is I have a TED Talk. It's 17 minutes, and it takes people from zero to, you know, pretty good understanding of what we're up to here in this 17 minutes, and you can find that by Googling my name, Catherine Gale, and TED Talk. And it's just right there. And if you sent that to two people and said you thought this was worth a look, they'll watch it because you sent it. And then they can be one of the people in Wisconsin who wants our legislators to make this change.
All right, great. Thanks for joining us. And it was great seeing everyone in person again.
Great, thank you. Thank you so much.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to today's episode with Catherine Gale. Just a reminder, if you got any value out of this episode, please share, write a review, subscribe. All of that helps get more ears on the Go Getters podcast, which is presented by Go Get It Marketing and Media, ggmm.io, and our friends over at On Milwaukee. And if you have any feedback, any suggestions, topics that you want to hear, just head to our website, ggmm.io. Click on the Go Getters tab, and there's a nice survey that you can fill out. And we even send you a gift if you take the survey. So please do that. Thanks again for tuning in.